This is ensemble member William Peterson, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
Hello, this is literary manager Joy Meads, and I'm here in conversation with playwright Bruce Norris, who's written A Parallelogram, the final show of our 2009-2010 season. Hello, Bruce.
Hey, hello. Thanks
for joining us today.
Thanks for putting me in this stuffy little booth.
So, Bruce, we noted on our first day of rehearsal that with A Parallelogram, you are now Steppenwolf's most produced playwright.
Are you sure that's right?
I don't think somebody said it.
I think it's probably Sam Shepard or someone. It's got to be someone else.
Well, I'll look it up afterwards. Yeah. Whether or not you're our most produced playwright, mm-hmm. you have certainly been produced here many times.
A lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot. And we're, of course, extraordinarily proud of our relationship with you.
It's because I have information on everyone in the company.
Blackmail. Well, can you tell us what it's like coming back to Steppenwolf? And, how has your relationship with Steppenwolf affected your career and your development as an artist?
Well, you know, I lived in Chicago for almost 20 years. And when I was in my 20s here, I looked at Steppenwolf as the kind of impossible place to work. It was so rarefied to work at Steppenwolf that I assumed I would never be able to do that. And then in 98, I think, or 99, after I had moved to New York, Martha called me, and she had worked with me before as an actress in a play I had written, not at Steppenwolf. And so she called me and asked me if I wanted to participate in the New Plays Initiative, I think it was called. And so she got me to write a play. Now, at that time, I never met most of the Steppenwolf company and certainly never worked with any of them. So everything about it was quite daunting. But now, when I come back, it feels like I'm coming back to my old apartment. Like, you know, oh, this is still here. Oh, I forgot to clean up the... Everything about it is familiar to the point of being a little scary.
Scary in what way?
Well, just that everyone knows the way I think, and I know the way a lot of the company members think because I've worked with a lot of them now. Mm-hmm. And so it's like visiting your family. Mm-hmm. It's both your anticipation is high and the potential for conflict is equally high.
Yeah, we often say that we phrase it as a benefit of ensemble is that, you know, you can call other people on their bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
But I can understand why it might be a less comfortable experience in some
because
ways.
Because they can call me on mine.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. Well, speaking of people being able to call people on their bullshit and people being able to call you on yours, this production also marks a continuation of your longtime collaboration with Anna Shapiro, mm-hmm. who's directed, I believe, four of your previous plays mm-hmm. here at Steppenwolf. Tell us about what makes you return to Anna as a director. What does she understand about your work that other people don't?
That's an interesting question. You know, Anna and I, when we first met each other, I think I instinctively disliked Anna. This was many years ago, and part of the reason why I did is because she and I have a very similar vocabulary. The way that we talk about the things that we experience and the work we do is very similar, and we have a similar tempo in how we think about things. And so in my initial encounter with her, I thought, this person is in competition with me, so therefore I don't like her because she's trying to pull a fast one on me, to be smarter than me. As we got to be collaborators and friends, she has become actually sort of like a sister to me, that she's like someone who I feel okay having a sometimes really noisy disagreement with, because I know that ultimately we share a sort of philosophy of working. What her strength is as a director, I think, is that she has a really unique sense of the broad overview of a play and how you get from the beginning of the play to the end and what the intention of the author is. I think she's really careful about diagnosing what that is and honoring the solution that she comes up with.
I hesitate before discussing the content of A Parallelogram in too much depth because part of the pleasure of the play is unraveling its mysteries as mm-hmm. it goes along. But I think I can safely mention that it's concerned in part with the idea of time travel.
Yeah.
So I think very skilled playwrights, a category which I would certainly include you in, often utilize form as another means of exploring content and mm-hmm. exploring the ideas within the play. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about when you started thinking about employing the device of time travel within a play what led you to use it, and how does it relate to the existential questions within the play?
Well, I don't know exactly when I started to contemplate that as a device or for structuring the play. It occurred to me several years ago, and long before I knew what the story of the play would be. But I think it has to do. The reason I think people are interested in time travel as a way of looking at an imaginary situation is that it provides you with a kind of epic lens on your life, so that if you could travel 100 years into the future and see what your offspring did or what became of your life, or if you could travel back into the past. I mean, all of those things provide you with this, fantastic way to imagine a greater lens on your life than any of us ever can access, because we're all mired in the present and we can't get out of the present. So that's why I think it's so attractive as a storytelling device. It's impossible to achieve, so it will never. So we're fascinated in trying to achieve it. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the play, much of what the play is about is how over time your life goes from potential to real, and how your sense of yourself as a potential person with a lot of things that could happen to you and a lot of directions your life could take, suddenly, as I'm in middle age, you realize there is no more potential anymore. This is just the life that you're living. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of distressing thought, because you can no longer look forward to what you're going to be. You simply are what you are.
Yeah. It's interesting. You shared with us a video that helped inform your thinking about time called
Imagining the Tenth Dimension.
The Tenth Dimension. Mm-hmm. And there's a way of thinking about the multiplicity of timelines and possibilities that any one person could travel along.
Right.
And that there are certain changes one could perhaps make in the past, theoretically, in order to open up more potential timelines, more potential possibilities. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and you should feel free to decline to answer this question, as you've been pondering this play, do you see any moments in your own life, in your own history, that you think have either shut down or opened up, some of those potential Bruce Norrises? Do you think that you could go back and significantly alter the trajectory of your life by changing their moments? Or do you see that trajectory as relatively fixed by your character and perhaps the limits of human endeavor to actually significantly change our environment?
I guess I see it as largely fixed. Part of what we learn, the central character of the play learns in the course of the play, is that she can make lots of little changes along the way in her life. Mm-hmm. But that many things about her life, for example, like your longevity, how you look, certain things that could happen to you, those things are sort of out of your control. Mm-hmm. And in my own life, I fantasize all the time that I could have there's a great Wally Shawn quote about wanting to wake up in the morning and be a different person. He says, why can't I just wake up tomorrow and be different from me? But I wake up every morning and I'm still me. And that's what I feel about myself, is that I'm trapped in my own consciousness and there's no way out, no time travel is available to me, no alternate personality or alternate reality is accessible to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just stuck for eternity as me, which is pretty grim in a way.
And are there things that you think are within your capacity or within your control? Are there ways in which you are able to create change,
Or create change on what scale?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So you're saying that the big changes are out of your reach. So what is within your reach to shape?
I have a history of heart attack in my family. So if I go to the gym and I eat certain kinds of food, I might prevent that heart attack from arriving for a significant amount of time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it'll probably catch up with me and it'll probably fell me. And I know that. Mm-hmm. But I can only make certain kinds of temporary changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that there's, especially in the West, there's a heresy in saying you can't change your life. People will get very angry if you say that, for example, if you say to someone, your life didn't have much of an impact on the world, and there's nothing else you can do to change that. If you present that limitation to people, they will reject it, and they'll get actually angry with you because they'll say, my life was meaningful. And frequently, the way they say it is, well, I had children. I have children. Those children are going to live on, and they'll have children, and so therefore, there's all these changes that I've brought into the world. Of course, if you don't have children, and that's one of the things we learn about the character of Bee in the play, she doesn't have children, then that puts that entire question in consideration of what your impact upon the world is. That puts it into stark relief.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you connect it to the American character. Have you read or heard of the Barbara Ehrenreich book, Brightsided?
No.
It's a book that started from...
Yes, I have. Actually, yes. Now that you mention it, I have heard about it.
Yeah, just for anybody who hasn't read it, Barbara Ehrenreich was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she found that the idea of the kind of gospel of our being able to control our destinies through the way we think had so taken hold that actually, whenever she would express, you know, some of the natural negative emotions that one would have in finding that out that one has a serious cancer, it was almost as though she did something incredibly rude.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
There was intense social
pressure
to be very positive. And she connects this to the economic bubble that we just had, you know, the way that naysayers were kind of hounded out of their organization,
right,
you know, of their
right.
businesses, and also the way that we equip people who have been laid off, you know, the way that they're supposed to deal with that. They're, you know.
Well, look at the recent presidential election. I mean, what is the mantra that got a guy into the White House? It's about hope and change.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound all Sarah Palin-ish, but that's an easy thing to say and a much, much more difficult thing to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
And the heresy for Americans is to deny the truth of the gospel of optimism. That gospel is so, it's so important to us, it drives our economy, that for anyone to entertain negative thoughts about what you can do, what change you can make in the world, that's actually considered almost like a bad omen. It's almost like taboo. You shouldn't speak of that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In a parallelogram, we learn that some decades in the future, an avian flu pandemic wipes out the bulk of humanity. If you did, in fact, have some supernatural insight into the future, what do you see happening to the human race?
Well, first, to clarify, I'm not sure whether or not in parallelogram the human race is going to be wiped out by a pandemic. That seems to be the case, but we don't know. I guess what I'd say is I think humans will eventually become extinct. I don't think it's any time in the near future unless there's some asteroid out there that we don't know about. And I think global warming isn't going to kill us. We're just going to move northward. I think changes happen so slowly, the changes that will wipe us out occur so slowly that we're never going to know how to take action to defend ourselves against them because they'll sneak up on us before we even know they're happening. But, you know, we'll go eventually. Every species goes eventually.
In a way, it's comforting. Thank you very much for talking
to us,
Bruce.
Yeah.
If you'd like to find out more about A Parallelogram or the rest of Steppenwolf's programming, please visit us at www.steppenwolf.org.